Chapter 22. An Idea. Brothers. The Ordained Hour. Ishak was faintly concerned that he was going to die down here, but that wouldn't stop him enjoying it while it lasted. The other remembrances whined on and on, badgering their Yukar aides about where would be best to observe the battle without actually getting anywhere near it. Apparently, they'd forgotten the honour of getting sent down here shortly after first setting foot on solid ground. Most of them seemed dedicated to completely missing the whole point of making planetfall in the first place, but that was fine by Ishak. He wasn't here to babysit their careers. The ride down to the surface had been an uneventful drift through the afternoon sky, anticlimactic after all the tension of being selected, and boring enough for Ishak to start wondering if there was really a war going on at all. The limited view from the dirty windows had revealed a distant city of obviously human construction below. Strange to consider waging war against such a familiar scene. Their lander was an army troop transport, a shaking, rattling example of the ancient grey wing class shuttles that he'd assumed are out of service these days, replaced by the smaller, sleeker Valkyries. Ishak had looked at the boxy underslung compartment where the 30 passengers were evidently supposed to travel. He'd looked at the sloping wings, ran a gloved hand over the armour plating, pockmarked from battle and painted with faded lightning bolts from the Emperor's unification wars on Terra 2 centuries before. And he'd fallen in love. He snapped several pics of the venerable old girl, pleased with each and every one of them. "What's her name?" he asked the pilot, who was standing around with the 2 dozen army soldiers on the hangar deck and looking just as annoyed. "They didn't name them back then when she was made. Too many produced too fast by too few facilities."
"I see. So what do you call her?"
He pointed at the faint stenciled print along the hull. E1L-1X11-8E22. The man thawed a touch at Cadine's interest.
"Elizabeth. We call her Elizabeth."
"Sir," Ishak grinned, "permission to come aboard, your fine lady."
So it had started well. Once they were down, things took a turn for the worse. The officer in nominal command of their expedition wasn't an officer at all. He was a Yukar sergeant who'd drawn the short straw and had to babysit the gaggle of pretension and nervousness that made up 10 highly strung artists in a war zone. Ishak half listened to the sergeant, arguing with a handful of the other remembrancers about just where would be acceptable for them to enter the city. He was already bored, standing on the edge of a rise about 3 kilometres from the city limits. The place itself looked no different from any industrialised sprawl on Terra, and there weren't even any obvious signs of battle. The nature of Astarte's assault presented a problem for the people attempting to chronicle the event. A direct drop-pod attack against the palace meant the remembrancers had to cross an entire hostile city alone, or would remain outside the city limits and ultimately witness nothing at all. The former was never going to happen, the latter almost definitely was. Ishak Cadine was a naturally suspicious soul, and he felt a bleak sense of humour behind all this. Someone, perhaps even the Crimson Lord himself, was making fun of them all, inviting them down here, but keeping them tediously safe and out of the way. He trudged over to his minders, 2 men in the neat ochre uniforms of the Yukar 81st. Each of the remembrancers was similarly guarded. Ishak's own sentinels looked both bored and annoyed all at once, which was quite a feat for human facial expressions.
"What if we just flew over to the palace?" he suggested. "And get shot down?"
The Yukar was practically spitting. "That piece of shit would catch fire and fall out of the sky as soon as it came into range of the anti-air guns." With effort, Ishak kept his smile cordial.
"Then fly really, really high and come down sharp on top of the palace. Then find somewhere to land."
He demonstrated this feat of aeronautics with his hands. They didn't seem convinced.
"Not happening," one of them said.
Ishak turned without another word, heading back into the dark confines of the Grey Wing's passenger pod. When he emerged again, he had a plastique personal grav chute pack tucked under one arm, clearly taken from the overhead storage lockers.
"Then how about this? We fly really damn high, and anyone who actually wants to do their job can jump out and do it."
The 2 soldiers shared a glance and called their sergeant over.
"What is it?"
the sergeant said, his face painted enough of a picture.
He needed another whining artist like he needed a hole in his head. This one, the soldier pointed at Ishak. He's had an idea.
It took 20 minutes for the idea to become reality, and Ishak regretted it right about the same time he jumped out of the gunship and started falling. Below him sprawled the white stone palace, like something from ancient Hellas, in Terra's decadent past. It was coming up to meet him with surprising speed, while the wind was doing its best to beat him unconscious. This, he thought, may have been a mistake. He tapped the switches on his chest buckle that would engage the grav chute. First one, then the other, first one, then the other.
Wait 20 seconds before you switch it on, the sergeant had said to the few of them that were making the drop. 20 seconds. Understood?
Wait 20 seconds. The wind roared against him, and the ground swelled below. Was he going to be sick? He hoped not. The queasiness in his stomach flipped and bubbled.
Ugh.
Wait 20 seconds. No sign of anti-air fire, at least. He could make out a spot among one of the inner courtyards, a blackened stain where a red drop pod had beached itself. That was a good place to start. Wait 20 seconds. How long had he been falling?
Oh, shit!
Ishak looked up. Through bleary goggles, he could see his two minders above. Both were far, far higher than him, shrinking all the while. Even smaller, above them both, were the others who'd caught onto his plan and given it enough credence to come with him. He flicked the switches, first the blue, then the red. For several moments, absolutely nothing happened. Ishak continued his plummeting death dive, too surprised to even swear. He started flicking the switches in random panic, little realizing that by doing so, he wasn't giving it time to warm up and engage. The grav chute finally kicked in hard enough to wrench the muscles in his neck, its gravity suspensors humming as they came alive. The late activation saved Ishak from becoming a red smear along the wall of a palace tower, but he paid the price for distraction. Laughing with terror, he careened off the stone parapet, bouncing, giggling, and trying not to soil himself as he tumbled through the air. 48 seconds later, the first of his minders touched down in the courtyard. He found Ishak Kadeen, a bloody mess, cradling his picture in bruised hands as he sat on the grass, rocking back and forth.
Did you see that?
He grinned at the soldier. 3 remembrances, 6 Yukar soldiers. A strike force of 9 souls moving through the corridors of the palace. It was a scantily decorated affair with little in the way of art or ornamentation. The architecture was all pillars and arched roofs, while uncarpeted stone floors led them deeper into the structure, which had all the charm and warmth of a mountaintop monastery. When they'd first entered the palace, leaving the fire-blackened Astartes drop pod behind, Ishak had wondered how they'd know which way to go. It turned out to be a needless worry. They just followed the bodies. Evidence of the Astartes passing was everywhere. This wing of the palace was swept clean of life, with ruptured corpses left in place of traditional decoration. One of the other remembrances, a whippet-lean imagist by the name of Kalia, would pause every few seconds and compose a pict around the dead bodies. It was clear from the angle of her picture that she sought to avoid any real focus on the slain, perhaps leaving them as blurred images in the foreground. Ishak had no interest in chronicling this butchery, artfully, tastefully, or otherwise. The ambitious mercenary part of his brain knew there'd be no point. Such work would never enter the most treasured archives. Truly morbid pieces rarely did. People on Terra wanted to see what humanity was capable of creating, not the aftermath of what it destroyed. They wanted to witness their champions in moments of glory or struggling in righteous strife, not slaughtering helpless humans that resembled Terrans far more than the Astartes themselves did. It was all about presentation, about presenting what people wanted to see, whether they knew it or not. So he left the bodies unrecorded. He tried not to look at the corpses they passed. Their ruination was so brutally complete, it was difficult to imagine that these gobbets of meat had ever been people. They hadn't just been killed, they'd been destroyed. One of the soldiers, Zamikov, caught Ishak's eye.
Chain blades, he said.
What?
The look on your face. You're wondering what does this to a body. Well, it's chain swords.
I wasn't wondering that, Ishak lied.
No shame in honest horror. Zamikov shrugged. I've been with the Serrated Sun 12 years now, and I puked my way through the first two. The Crimson Lord's lot do messy work.
They took a left, stepping through another broken barricade that had failed to do its job. Gunfire in the distance hastened their strides.
I'd heard the Word-Bearers always incinerated their enemies. They do.
Zamikoff hiked a thumb over his shoulder at the corpses arrayed in various pieces around the furniture barricade.
That'll come afterwards. First they kill, then they purify. They come back to burn the dead after a battle? They actually do it themselves?
Zamikoff nodded, no longer looking over at the imagist. Ishak noticed the shift in the soldier's stride. As soon as they'd heard the gunshots, each of the Yukars moved lower, faster, their las rifles clutched tighter. It was like watching Hive Street cats on the hunt for rats.
They do it themselves. No funerary serfs or corpse servitors for the Word-Bearers. They're a thorough lot, you'll see. I can already see.
That a fact?
Zamikoff spared him a quick glance.
What do you see here?
Bodies.
Ishak raised an eyebrow. What kind of question was that?
It's more than that.
The soldier looked ahead again.
This entire wing of the palace is cleaned out. But we've doubled back on ourselves more than once following the trail of the dead. The Word-Bearers aren't racing to the throne room. That's not how they do things. They're killing everyone in the palace first, room by room, chamber by chamber. That's punishment. That's being thorough. You understand now?
Ishak nodded, not sure what else to say. The sound of gunfire was joined by the guttural whine of motorized blades. He felt his heart quicken. This was it. Battle. Seeing the Astartes fight, and hopefully not getting shot at himself.
Look alive, the sergeant grunted. Rifles up.
Ishak didn't have a rifle, but with his face set just as stern as Amikov's, he raised his picta. When they caught up to the Word-Bearers, the scene was nothing like he'd expected. Firstly, it wasn't a squad of Word-Bearers. It was just one. And secondly, he wasn't alone. The picta clicked and clicked and clicked. They were twins in movement, a single weapon with a single intent. Neither led the other, neither moved any more or less than his twin. It was not competition. It was the perfection of unity. They stopped as one, ending their advance to take stock of their surroundings. The city was in the throes of evacuation, for whatever good it would do the populace, and the air was a wailing morass of conflicting sirens, audible even here within the palace. Platoons of defenders stood at every corridor corner and junction, armed with solid-shot rifles that cracked and pinged harmlessly off Astartes' armor. The Vox network was calm. No cries for reinforcement, no demands for orders. The monotonous chanting, so typical of Word-Bearer squads, was absent from the Gal Vorbach. 40 warriors drop-podded into 4 sections of the royal castle, immediately splitting up to slaughter with muted grunts and growls. Another barricade stood before the 2 advancing warriors, manned by dozens of the rifle-armed defenders in their ostentatious white and gold garb. Puffs of smoke preceded the click-clack-click of their bullets, sparking harmlessly aside. Both warriors broke into a run, boots crunching into the stone floor. Both vaulted the barricade of smashed furniture in the same moment, both grunting in effort as they leapt. Both landed at the same time, and both let loose with abandon, their weapons lashing out to shed blood. The defenders fell in pieces around them, chopped and carved faster than the eye could follow. Ruthless familiarity with each other was all that made this possible. When one would weave low to thrust, the other would aim high to slice. Their movements were a blurring dance around each other's forms, forever watching and anticipating the other's movements, even as they focused on slaying their enemies. Around the 2 warriors, 19 defenders were twitching human wreckage. The last to die had been disemboweled and decapitated by both warriors in the same heartbeat. Now blood ran from the sword's blade, just as it ran from the 8 talons. Back to back, the warriors glanced at the ruination around them, took half a second's note of the Yukars escorting the remembrancers down the hallway, and moved on in the same second. Aquilon ran. Argeltal staggered. Surprise froze the custodian's movements dead. As he turned, he saw the Word-Bearer take another flawed step and crash to his knees among the corpses they'd created. Aquilon span his blade, a deflective propeller to ward off any assassin's shot. He wasn't connected to the Legion's network data stream and couldn't read Argyltal's life signs on a convenient retinal display. But there was no blood, no sign of injury, beyond the collapse and spasm.
"Are you hit?"
Argyltal answered with wordless rasps. Something wet and black dripped from his helm's mouth grill, thinner than oil, thicker than blood, hissing like acid as it fell to the stone. Aquilon stood above the prone word-bearer, sword spinning in his gold hands. No matter where he looked, he couldn't gain a target lock. There was no assassin, at least none that he could see. He risked another glance down.
"Brother! Brother, what ails you?"
Argyltal used his claws to rise, digging them into the wall and dragging himself to his feet. Black bubbles, silvered by saliva, swelled and popped at his mouth grill. He said, in a greasy blurt of vox. The twitching was subsiding, but the word-bearer seemed in no hurry to move.
"What struck you down?"
"Nothing. Nothing."
Argyltal's voice was a breathy wheeze.
"I... tell me you hear that."
"Hear what?"
Argyltal gave no answer. The scream in his mind went on and on, a sound of sorrow and anger somehow ripened by amusement, a meaningless melange of incompatible emotion curdled into a single scream. Each second it lasted, his blood boiled hotter.
"Let's move on,"
he growled at Aquilon through chattering teeth.
"Brother, move on!"
Torgal screamed in unison with a distant cry, sending human defenders panicking before him. The Galvorback warriors by his side dropped their weapons, hands clutching at helms, wordless shouts of anguish, vox roaring throughout the throne chamber. Psychopomp Shal Ves Nalia IX watched this sudden madness through tears in her eyes. The ruler of the planet Kallis had, before this moment, been curled in her oversized throne, a mess of rich robes containing rolls of fat, weeping and wailing for all to hear. The last survivors of her royal guard, those who'd not fled to leave her to die at the hands of the invaders, were similarly taken aback now as the red-armored slaughterers howled and ceased their butchery. The guard's ceremonial blades were worthless against Astarte's armor, as were their solid-shot rifles. Instead of pressing the attack, they used the momentary respite to fall back to the psychopomp's throne.
"Highness, it's time to leave,"
a house captain told her. This was a refrain he'd been trying for days, but if it wouldn't work now, at least he'd never need to try again. She blubbed in response. Her chins jiggled.
"Forget her,"
one of the others said. All of their faces were taut under the pressure of the invaders screaming so loud.
"This is our chance, Rivas."
"Defend me," the matriarch wailed. "Do your duty. Kill them all."
Rivas was 52 years old and had served most loyally as house captain to the current psychopomp's father, who'd been a charismatic and effective ruler beloved by his people. Everything his fat bitch of a daughter was not. But he couldn't leave. Or rather, he wouldn't. Rivas turned to the prone invaders, watching them kneel and cry out in the sea of carved corpses around them, and made the last decision he would ever make. He would not run. It was not in him to do so. Instead, he would defend his sire's indolent daughter with his life, breaking his blade upon the armor of his enemies, making sure his final words would be to spit defiance in their faces.
"Turn and run, dogs!"
he snarled at his own men.
"I will die doing my duty!"
Half of them seemed to take that as an order, for they fled immediately. Rivas watched their dark-armored forms slipping into servants' passages, and despite himself, couldn't wish harm upon them for their cowardice. The house captain remained in the screaming maelstrom with eight men, all too proud or too dutiful to run, and all on the veteran side of 40.
"We're with you,"
one of them said, his voice raised to make it above the shouts.
"Defend me,"
the hideous girl wailed again.
"You have to protect me."
Reva spoke a small prayer of reverence, wishing the shade of her father well, and promising to see him soon in the afterlife. The invaders rose again. The screams faded to moans and grunts. They reached for weapons that had fallen into the gore. Rivas yelled,
"Charge!"
and did exactly that. He cared nothing for slaying one of the invaders, for he knew he couldn't. All he wished to do was break his blade upon their red armor, to land a single blow when so many of the royal guard had died without even striking once. One moment he ran and roared, the next he was crashing to the floor. There wasn't even any pain, as his legs went out from under him, just a moment of dizziness before looking up to see the crimson warrior towering above. His blade remained unbroken, his last wish denied. The invader stepped on the dying man's chest, crushing every bone in his torso and pulping the organs. House Captain Rivas died without even knowing his legs and waist were 3 meters away, severed from his body by the Red Warrior's first blow. Torgal dispatched the last of the ardent defenders, reaching the throne before the other Gal Vorbach. Acidic bile still stung his throat, but control and strength alike had returned to his limbs. The Vox was a frenetic exchange of squads, all reporting the same crippling pain and the sound of laughter.
"Leave my world!"
the psychopomp squealed from her chair. Torgal plucked her up by her fat neck. The weight was considerable, even for Astarte's battle armour. He felt gyros in his shoulder and elbow joints lock to deal with a strain. Next to him, Selfaris was replacing his helm after spitting black bile at one of the dead bodies.
"Just kill the piggish creature. We need to return to orbit. Something is wrong."
Torgal shook his head. "Nothing is wrong." He did his best to ignore the girl's weeping protests.
"But we must commune with a chaplain at once. If this is the ordained hour, we must..."
"What?"
Selfaris was almost laughing.
"What must we do? I am hearing a spirit laughing inside my skull, while my blood boils hot enough to burn my bones. We have no plan for this. None of us truly believed it would ever come."
"Leave my world," the matriarch insisted. "Leave us in peace."
Torgal sneered at her behind his faceplate, loathing her down to the wretched alien fish stink of her sweating skin. What abominable event in this world's past had led to such deviancy? What could make such desecration? The corruption of the human genome with alien genetics, a necessary reality? These people seemed no stronger, no more enlightened, no more industrious than any other human culture. In truth, they were less advanced than most.
"Why did you do this to yourselves?"
the Astartes asked.
"Leave my world! Leave!"
He threw her aside. The fleshy pile crashed to the ground. Her dynasty ended by a broken neck.
"Burn everything," ordered Torgal. "Burn it all, and summon a Thunderhawk. We stand at the ordained hour. I will report to the Crimson Lord."
The Crimson Lord surveyed the courtyard, empty but for the grounded gunship. He lowered his claws. Torgal reported the monarch's downfall almost an hour before, but Argeltal's fervour had faded even before the announcement. With the echo of that silent scream still drifting through his skull, he stood in the shadows of his Thunderhawk Rising Sun, abstaining from the final slaughter within the palace. With flamers and incendiary grenades, the Gal Vorbach were erasing all evidence of royal life, gutting the pillared palace from within. Most were voxing questions to one another, coating the communication network in a buzz of aggressive, amused voices. The words "ordained time" surfaced with sickening frequency. Their blood was up, for it seemed the gods had called. Aquilon had followed him, which was the first thing he expected, and the very last thing he needed. The four custodies were scattered among the word-bearers assaulting the palace. They had surely seen everything, and that was going to become a problem sooner rather than later. Argeltal watched the man he would soon be ordered to kill, and wondered if he were capable of the act, both physically and morally.
"I have no answer for you," Argeltal told him. "I do not know what happened. A momentary weakness played over me. I forced it back. That is all I can tell you."
The custode sighed through his helm speaker.
"And you are well now?" "Yes, my strength returned quickly. There has been no moment of similar weakness."
"My men report similar incidents," the custodian said. "Many of the Gal Vorbach fell as if struck by unseen hands at the same moment you lapsed yourself."
Aquilon removed his helm in a gesture of familiarity. It was a gesture that went unreturned.
"We have detected no enemy weaponry capable of creating such an effect."
He could only meet Aquilon's gaze with his own eyes guarded by the lenses of his helm.
"If I knew what had afflicted me," Argeltal said, "I would tell you, brother.
We have to consider that this is some previously unknown flaw in your legion's gene seed.
Argyltal grunted a vague noise that may or may not have been affirmation.
You understand, the custodian continued. I must report this to the Emperor, beloved by all, at once.
Behind his faceplate, Argyltal was drooling blood again.
Yes, he said, licking his lips clean. Of course you must.
At first, he believed the scream was returning. Only after listening to its ululating wail for several moments did he turn back towards the palace walls.
Do you hear that?
He asked. This time Aquilon nodded.
Yes, I do.
When the siren started, almost all of the word-bearers requested confirmation of its origins. The Colchisian rune, flickering across hundreds of retinal displays, told a blunt, stark tale, but it was a story that made no sense. Even among the Galvorbak, the red-clad warriors hesitated in their fire-bearing purges, voxing to the orbiting fleet for immediate confirmation and explanation. In the courtyard, Argyltal and Aquilon boarded the rising sun, ordering their warriors to return to their dropships without hesitation. The Psychopomp's palace no longer mattered. This entire compliance was now meaningless.
All word-bearers, all custodies, all Imperial Army forces of the 1301st Expeditionary Fleet, hear these words. This is Argyltal, Master of the Serrated Sun. Word has reached De Profundis from Terra itself, bearing the seal of the Emperor. The Istvan system is in open rebellion, led by four of our own legions. Rumours are rife and facts are few. It is said the War Master has renounced his blood oaths to the throne world. True or false, we will not go to war blinded by ignorance. But we will answer the Primarch's call, for Lorgar himself demands we respond. Disengage from the surface attack and regroup at your transports. Return to orbit at once. We are ordered to Istvan, and we will obey as we were born to obey. The word-bearers will cut to the heart of this betrayal, tearing the truth out from within. Officers, to your stations. Warriors, to your duties. That is all for now.
Aquilon stood with the Crimson Lord in the gunship's crew bay.
I cannot give this even a moment's belief. Horus? A traitor?
The custodian ran his fingertips over the flat of his sword's blade.
This cannot be true.
You heard the message, just as I.
Argyltal blink-clicked a runic marker on his visor display, opening a vox channel to the Galvorbak.
Confirm network security.
Another rune twinned with the first, blinking in reassurance.
This is Argyltal.
He spoke only to his closest brothers now.
Aurelian calls us.
A voice answered without the aid of vox, drifting through his senses with maddening familiarity.
They already know. They sense it. I know this voice, he thought. Of course we know it. It is our own voice. We are Argyltal.